Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the program today, the numerology of those settlements some of the big banks have been paying of late. And also, just because it is summertime, beer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here, everybody. It is the 9th of July, and the number of the day this Wednesday is $7 billion. $7 billion. That's what Citigroup is said to be set to pay to settle charges with the Justice Department over questionable mortgage-backed securities and other shenanigans during the housing boom and bust. It is not the first, nor is it likely the last, 10 or more figure payment from a bank closing out an unsavory episode. And we have looked before at where the money goes and who is often responsible for the misdeeds. But where does the payment number itself come from? The, in this case, $7 billion. It's a lot of money. Is it art? Is it science? Is it a little bit of black magic? I don't know. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith gets us going.
There's an art and a science to figuring out a settlement like this, says James Cox, professor of securities law at Duke.
So they began by looking at how much was actually underwritten by Citibank. And then the next thing is trying to compare that with what happened before.
What happened before being J.P. Morgan's settlement. Charles Peabody has crunched those numbers. He's with financial research firm Portales.
Their total settlement was about $13 billion. On $460 billion of residential mortgage-backed securities underwritten, that represented about a 3% penalty.
Using that formula, Citigroup should only owe about $2.5 billion, not $7 billion. Citi sold about $90 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. But, says Peabody, Citi played a more active role in its investments.
Most of Citigroup's losses were in bonds that they underwrote themselves, where a lot of the losses in the case of J.P. Morgan and Bank of America came from firms that they acquired during the financial crisis.
Like Toxic Mortgage Machines, Bear Stearns, and Washington Mutual, which J.P. Morgan acquired under the supervision of the government. And then there's the element of negotiation. Citigroup may have floated the $7 billion figure to see how shareholders would take it. John Coffey directs Columbia's Center on Corporate Governance.
And they may resist and push back more if they're getting a very negative reaction from the market.
So far, Citigroup investors are holding pretty steady. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We are, as of this week, in corporate earnings season. How do I know that? I know that because Alcoa reported profits yesterday. They get to go first for some reason that is lost to business history. But its results don't carry the same heft as they used to. Back before the Dow Jones Industrial Average bumped Alcoa from its lineup, which was, in point of fact, just last year. Like a lot of early industrial giants, Alcoa sees its future in getting away from its industrial business, in this case smelting aluminum, into something a little bit fancier. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
It's not hard to hear the air quotes Morningstar analyst Andrew Lane uses when he recalls Alcoa's conference call.
CEO Klaus Kleinfeld referred to the company numerous times as a lightweight, multi-material innovation powerhouse.
Lane thinks the company will keep making money by making aluminum for a long time. But he also says, yes, a lot of Alcoa's profits come from new lines in metals like titanium and from special alloys for the aluminum body on the new Ford F-150 truck coming out next year. And the company
now has a $5 billion aerospace business.
That's Stern AG analyst Josh Sullivan, who generally covers the aerospace business, not raw materials companies. So when did a company known for mining and smelting metal turn itself into an aerospace company?
Well, Alcoa's actually always been an aerospace company.
Because if you wanted to build an airplane to fight World War II, or a rocket ship, or a 737, you needed the strongest, lightest metal you could get.
We don't think of aluminum as an advanced metal, but at one point it was, you know, the most advanced metal there was out there.
Business historian George David Smith says Alcoa was always a high-tech company. It had a major R&D department until it lost a big antitrust case to the U.S. government after World War II. Among the outcomes?
They had to provide their patent rights to their new competitors, namely Kaiser and Reynolds Corporations, free of charge.
Alcoa did pull back a bit from basic research after that. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
No matter how many press conferences Janet Yellen does, one never quite knows exactly what the Federal Reserve is thinking, which is why it's worth a note that the minutes from the Fed's June meeting were released today. There was no silver bullet or anything, just a little more certainty, I suppose you'd say, about when its big bond buying program, quantitative easing, is going to end. October, it now looks like. Nothing at all about when it might actually raise interest rates. Wall Street today, it was up, but traders were not all that enthusiastic about things. We will have the details when we do the numbers. This is what you might call the slack period in higher education. Summer break, campuses are quiet, admissions decisions have been made, incoming freshmen are making their plans. Most freshmen, that is. A lot of kids from poor families who do get accepted to college never wind up actually enrolling. They get stymied by the forms and the financial paperwork, and they just give up. From St. Louis Public Radio, Tim Lloyd has the story.
Ivana Brown just graduated from high school and plans on going to college this fall. She's thinking either community college or the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
And that's pretty exciting. That's actually a big deal for me.
A big deal because she'll be the first in her family to go to college. But she says the process can be overwhelming.
You do always need help from someone to, like, give you some guidance.
So she made her way to the High School to College Center on a trendy part of St. Louis's Del Mar Loop. The center is designed to help low-income students like Brown get through everything that comes after the acceptance letter. There's not much to the office itself, just some folding tables and a couple of cubicles. But it's stocked with folks like Christine Alphen, a high school guidance counselor.
A majority of the students, they're afraid, so they don't do anything, and then the deadlines pass, and then they're in a position where they, you know, they don't end up going.
Alphen's describing what's called summer melt. Researchers estimate about 20% of low-income students who get accepted to college don't enroll in the fall. Some change their mind, of course. But many students get tripped up on all the paperwork, especially the financial aid process. There are private loans, public loans, scholarships, and reams of forms to go with all of it. Alphen says just providing proof of income to qualify for a need-based loan can be a hurdle.
You know, even a letter saying that your family doesn't have any means, so we need to verify that you have no means. Well, that process itself can be very intimidating for families.
The High School to College Center in St. Louis opened its doors last summer and is run by a network of local corporations, nonprofits, and educators called St. Louis Graduates. The group pulled together $52,000 in grants and donations to hire staff like Alphen for the summer. Faith Sandler is the network's co-chair. She says money is also available to help kids and families travel to things like freshman welcome events.
Because otherwise, we run the potential of losing the human possibility that's resident in each one of the young people coming through that door.
In addition to counseling, students are getting some high-tech help in the form of a software system known as Bridget. It's programmed to send text messages to students about all the stuff they need to do to stay on track. Things like reserving a spot in student housing and submitting immunization records. Should the kids start to slide off the rails, Bridget can raise a red flag.
And counselors can use the Bridget system to pinpoint those students and focus their attention on those students in particular.
Lindsay Page is an assistant professor of education at the University of Pittsburgh. She's part of a research team studying how this type of technology can help get more students enrolled and then keep them on track once they're in school.
These kinds of low-cost strategies can also help students persist in college.
This takes us back to that little student counseling center in St. Louis. Jasmine Huey, who has a summer job at the center, got help here herself last summer and just wrapped up her freshman year at Southeast Missouri State University.
If it wasn't for them, I probably wouldn't have been able to go to school. I thought I had everything together, but I guess I was wrong.
The center kept tabs on more than half of the kids who received on-site assistance last summer. And by the fall, 86% of them were enrolled in either full or part-time classes. In St. Louis, I'm Tim Lloyd for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
A couple of months ago, the European Court of Justice ruled that people have a right to be forgotten, to have erroneous or irrelevant things about them deleted from online search results. BBC economics editor Robert Peston has discovered that that ruling has run right into the historical economic record. The record in the form of an article he wrote back in October 2007 about the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, Stan O'Neill was his name. The BBC got a takedown notice about that piece from Google. Mr. Peston, thanks for being here.
Great pleasure.
What happened? How did this happen?
Well, they just sent an email saying that this particular article was no longer going to be findable in searches on Google in Europe. I found this really profoundly shocking because this was, you know, I wouldn't say it's the greatest bit of journalism I've ever done, but it was a perfectly legitimate bit of journalism about the mess at Merrill Lynch and the fact that its boss, Stan O'Neill, was being ousted. And given how important the financial crisis turned out to be for all our lives, you know, it seemed to me that unfettered access to those sorts of articles was pretty important. We've got to remember that disaster.
The criteria is they will remove information, Google will, if it's inadequate, irrelevant, no longer relevant, or excessive. My guess is you don't feel that way.
Oh, there was nothing in the article that would in any sense meet those criteria. So I was shocked. I mean, it did seem to me this was an assault on the free press. Now, what we have subsequently learned is that these restrictions have been put in place because somebody who left a comment underneath my article no longer wants the world to see his or her comment. Now, I would argue that if you leave a comment on a public website like the BBC's, no one's coercing you to do that. And if in years to come you happen to be slightly embarrassed by what you said, well, too bad. Tough cheese.
Just a quick follow-up on the logistics of this. You called Google to find out what the heck was going on. They said they had hired, I think your word was, a small army of paralegals to handle all these removal requests.
Yep, that's what they said. Yeah, I mean, they've had now, believe it or not, this new law has been in effect for just a few weeks. They have had 70,000 requests across Europe for articles to no longer show up on searches. That's an enormous amount of essentially quasi-legal processing that has to go on. It must be costing them a fortune. And I would imagine, given the sheer number of requests they've had, that there'll be quite a lot of decisions made that many of us would think are just completely inappropriate.
Robert Peston is the economics editor for the BBC. His article about Stan O'Neill, while still available in some searches, has been generally taken down by Google. Mr. Peston, thanks very much for your time.
All the best.
Coming up.
At some point, the rate of growth of or expansion of into new breweries has to stop because eventually you have more breweries than people.
He says that like it's a bad thing. What? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 78 points today, 0.4%, 16,985. The NASDAQ up 27 points, 0.6%, 44.19. The S&P 500 up 9 points, 0.4%, 19.72. Alcoa started off this earnings season yesterday, as we mentioned, reported a bump in profits. It did shares up 5.5%. Citigroup is nearing a settlement over bad mortgages. As we told you about, the market could not care less. Citigroup shares off less than 0.1%. In the war between Amazon and Hachette over ebook profits, Hachette's authors are caught in the middle. So now the online giant has offered to give those authors all of the earnings from sales while things get worked out. Amazon shares up nearly 2% today. And a reminder that not every culture-shaping, generation-spanning business is publicly traded. Today, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, yes, they are, in fact, a business, released a box set of previously unreleased songs and a DVD from their tour back in 1974. Just how long has CSN been in business? Here's a quote. "We've been asked 1,000 times what it was like at Woodstock," David Crosby said at a release party. "My favorite answer is, I can't remember." That would have been 1969, David. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales for May. Chain stores are scheduled to report June sales. And on July 10, 1985, Coca-Cola said it would bring back original Coke after ditching it for new Coke a few months prior, stopping the irate protest of consumers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The road trip was once and may arguably still be the official vacation of summer. Maybe you've got memories of piling into a station wagon or a minivan at some point in your life and driving to a national park or a beach house or Disney World. And of course, you've got the stories and the pictures to remember them by and to share with friends. But if you want to tell the whole highway where you've been, the most popular way to do that for the past 20 years has been those small white oval stickers with a couple of letters on them that you put in your back window, or maybe you stick it on your bumper sticker. Those stickers, they are the subject of today's installment of our series, Summer, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
Marketplace's David Weinberg explains where those decals came from and how people react to them.
In 1994, Earl Williams was on Martha's Vineyard when a sticker on the back of a car caught his eye.
Well, actually, I saw an oval decal with an MV on it.
At the time, Williams sold decals and sports memorabilia to colleges. The first thing he thought when he saw the white oval with the MV on it was, I wonder if that thing is copyrighted.
I wanted to make sure we wouldn't step on somebody's toes.
Luckily for Williams, it wasn't. A few months later, he started making his own stickers with the initials VT for Vermont.
So we did them in traditional European black and white and did them in colors. And that's where we began.
Williams still sells decals out of his house in Stowe, Vermont. This year, he sold a little over a million. That's about half what he sold pre-recession. Though Williams markets his stickers as the original ovals, they were actually created by the United Nations in the 1940s as a way to identify the country of origin on automobiles traveling through Europe. In the U.S., they became a status symbol, EH for East Hampton, or AC for Nantucket, secret codes that said the driver of this car lives or vacations in America's most elite resorts.
I think the temptation is to be a little disdainful when you see those. I mean, if people were really confident of their position in life, they wouldn't feel any need to advertise it.
Robert Frank teaches economics at Cornell. He says these bumper stickers, in and of themselves, they're not a big deal, but they are an indicator of a bigger economic trend. The wealthiest Americans have been building larger and more ostentatious homes.
They're not bad people because they do that. That's just what everyone does when they get more money, but the fact that they build bigger houses shifts the frame of reference for people just below the top. They build bigger, too.
And those just below them build bigger houses, and on down the income ladder. Meanwhile, lower and middle class wages have stagnated, so everyone ends up spending more of their income to keep up. Frank says there's a similar competition to get into the most prestigious schools, not just universities, but increasingly grade schools, even preschools.
When a parent's child gets into a prestigious institution, the first thing that happens next is a decal on the back window of the car announcing that fact to the world.
As for the white oval decals, David Ewing isn't a fan. He grew up in Swampscott, Massachusetts, just outside Boston. His father was a lawyer at a Boston law firm, and his roots go way back in New England.
My dad's ancestor was one of the founders of Northampton, Mass., so it was 1600s.
Ewing spent his summer vacations in southern Maine and Nantucket, but he says his family would never have put a sticker on their car advertising that fact.
It was against their sensibility to show off, to the world at large, anyway.
Do you think that's like a part of a larger sort of generational thing? Sort of the old money, new money thing, like...
Oh, yeah, I think definitely, yeah. You know, there was a real, there was a distaste for ostentation. And there was a distaste for the term when we were growing up was a status symbol.
Today, Ewing lives in California, and he understands the impulse to put a sticker on your car that shows where you're from.
So on that level, if you're a long way from home, you're sort of waving your hand going, hey, anybody else out there?
Yeah. If you saw an MV or a Marblehead or bumper sticker, would you go up to the person and be like, oh, hey,
I'd avoid them like the plague.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
What follows now is, on the face of it, a story about beer, which is fine and all. It's summer, it's hot, nothing like a cold one to pass the time. But really, it's a story about entrepreneurship and knowing your market and knowing your product. A story that happens to feature as the product craft beer. Quite literally, just across town from Marketplace World headquarters here in L.A. sits Golden Road, a brewery and accompanying brew pub that opened in October 2011. Tony Yanow and Meg Gill are the founders, the quite insistent founders, I should say.
We need a beer in your hand.
Yeah, not while I'm working. Unlike you, my job doesn't actually encourage me to
Well, we have a 3.8 session IPA. I heard you're an IPA guy.
I am an IPA guy.
I can get you a small one if you want.
All right, give me a small one.
All right.
I'm doing this for Marketplace.
Cheers.
3 years ago, this was an empty warehouse, right?
It was an empty warehouse with nothing in it at all.
And now you have a fully functioning brewery, a whole line of beers, a restaurant and a brew pub set up. I mean, it's the speed at which this has happened is kind of amazing.
We have a lot of people that work really hard to make this happen every day, and Meg and I have been dedicated to it for, I mean, it must be close to 4 years now.
Yeah, we knew, you know, there was a lot of opportunity within craft beer.
Yeah.
But within a niche within craft beer, Los Angeles
That's like microscopic.
Well,
I mean, it's a big market.
You think about that, but there's 6 million barrels of beer sold in L.A. County a year. If we were to do one half of 1% of that, we'd be selling 300,000 barrels of beer, which this facility can't even do a third of that. So this market is enormous.
So there's upside potential. Is that what I hear?
Yes.
Lurking deep in some cold black corner of every craft brewer's heart has to be Sam Adams, which was maybe the craft brewer of record back in the day in this country, and now is just another beer company. How worried are you that as fast as you're growing? I mean, this is one of those questions I know the answer to before I ask, but
first
come
of,
on,
first
right?
First of all, I think there has to be a distinction between our sizes, right?
Well, yeah, but when year, Sam Adams was you guys, he was
35 years ago.
That's what I'm saying.
I'll be old and dead by then. I'm worried about it now.
Speak for yourself.
I think that Jim Cook and that company is of the most talented businesses in America, and they have brought craft beer back to America, you know, and they're 2.5 million barrels, and they're still growing, you know, 20%, and they're a public company, and they're still craft, you know, so we are. All right,
there are those who would argue with that, including me.
It's
on the shelf next to Budweiser.
Under the Brewers Association definition.
All right.
Boston beer is absolutely craft beer.
Right.
And, you know, as far as us kind of getting too big for our boots, we're already too big for our boots in some accounts. You know, you're never going to please everyone. I was at a restaurant late last night in downtown L.A., and they had 4 beers on draft. And those 4 beers, they will not put us on draft because we're over 1,000 barrels.
Wow, okay? Which is nothing.
So some restaurants now just want, you know, nano breweries, and that's fine.
That just must make you shake your head and go, come on.
You can't win. You try to service the customers
right.
who want your beer, and you try to help kind of bring them all the latest and the greatest and help them come into craft beer.
I went down to San Diego like 4 years ago and spent a morning with Greg Koch at Stone. And one of the things we talked about 4 years ago was the idea of a craft beer bubble. You guys are now buying into that bubble, if you were. I mean, you know, the Brewers Association will tell you craft beers are up 40-something percent in 2013. You worried about that?
Well, I would say at some point, the rate of growth of or expansion of into new breweries has to stop because eventually you have more breweries than people. So somewhere between now and then, it will stop. But the real question is, can you put the toothpaste back in the tube? Are people going to just say, you know what, we don't want good, interesting flavors. We just want beer.
Lousy, fizzy yellow water?
Well, yeah.
No,
and
come
you
on.
Know what? And there's a market for that, no doubt. I mean, that's still 93% of the market or whatever
yeah.
it is. That's what they're drinking. And God bless them, good. You know, that's not what we're doing. We are a local expression. Like, we're making beer that the people here want, that we want to drink, that we want to make. And what I do know is that people who like our beer and people who like craft beer like our beer, and they're not going to stop liking our beer. You know, like if it, we make good beer.
Before we go, remind me what we're drinking. I had a what?
You're drinking, I think, Wolf Among Weeds. Oh, no, you're drinking Across the Pond.
Across the Pond.
You're drinking Across the Pond.
Across the Pond.
Yeah, it's a low ABV session IPA. It's real easy to drink, but has a real nice floral, pungent hop aroma.
You had something out of the tank.
I am currently drinking Heal the Bay IPA.
There you go.
Between you and me, we have my two favorite. These are the two beers that are on tap at my house right now.
On tap at my house. He owns a brewery. They're on tap at my
house. These are probably the two most unavailable beers also to advertise on national radio.
That's all right.
So I love them all.
You can't get them anywhere.
And what were you having?
Point the Way IPA, our flagship, our bread and butter, 40% of our business.
Wow.
Easy drinking, West Coast dry IPA.
Thanks, you guys, so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which the president of the NCAA tries to have it both ways. Mark Emmert told a Senate panel today that college athletes ought to receive, and this is a quote, scholarships for life. I'm guessing he means getting the skills to succeed in life, because he went on to say that athletic scholarships ought to cover the whole cost of being in school, not just the bare bones. You remember there was a lot of press around that back around the NCAA basketball tournament. Emmert also said, and this is the having it both ways part, that he figures the current model of amateurism in college athletics is working well for most people. So there you go. And with that, that is Marketplace from 8 p.m. Today, the Dow up 78 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 27.6%. The S&P 500 put on 9 points. That is 0.4%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.